Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Dave James. In a moment, I'll talk with Jerry Snodgrass, executive director of the Ohio High School Athletic Association, which has had to make big decisions in this year of the pandemic, with more big decisions to come. We'll get into detail about it with a lengthy discussion in just a moment. Courtesy of 10TV, Scott Light will have a number of guests to talk about adapting and dealing with the virus, from comments from the governor and state health director to the mayor of Youngstown and the president of Columbus State Community College. And I'll wrap up the hour talking with Dennis Blair with the Westerville Sunrise Rotary Club about their Field of Heroes flag display for Memorial Day. It's open now through tonight into tomorrow afternoon in Westerville. First up on Columbus Perspective, Jerry Snodgrass, who's the executive director of the Ohio High School Athletic Association. How are you?
I'm doing well.
This, you know, I was going to ask you if you could sum up the last few months in just a word or a phrase. What would you say?
Last few months seem like the last few years. But it's something that's really tested patience, and just something that we've had no roadmap for, and you sometimes just had to go with your gut when it came to making decisions.
And before we get into some of the details on what's possible ahead, tell me a little bit about the Ohio High School Athletic Association and your role in it.
I'm glad you asked that, because through the years we've not told our story enough, and I think people believe that we are a tax-funded organization since we do work for the schools, and we're not. We are a nonprofit organization. 82% of our revenues to keep our doors open are derived from ticket sales. And so, you know, when people say it's all about the money, it's not all about the money. We are actually a very small staff. We currently have 20 full-time employees, and we are the fourth largest of any state association in the nation, meaning that we serve roughly 350,000 kids, roughly 65,000 coaches, and 814 high schools alone, and about another 900 junior highs. Wow. That all of those are about fourth largest in the nation. And our staff is relatively small. We're in the middle of the pack with a number of full-time staffers. So, again, a nonprofit, and we rely on those ticket dollars to provide the opportunities, and that's exactly what we do. Our mission statement is to serve our member schools to provide opportunities for kids in interscholastic athletics. So to meet that mission, it does take staff, it does take materials, it does take keeping the lights on, and all those go into the great opportunity to provide what's become an unbelievable part of society.
And you are executive director, and your role, from education to coaching, you have a background in all that coming out of Northwest Ohio.
I do, and I think that's one of the things that has helped me tremendously. I often say I'm a product of this organization. I grew up, you know, in Upper Sandusky, your rival, by the way. And I was lucky to have some good coaches and teachers that saw something in me, and I have no idea what at the time. And I'm one of those that could have strayed any different way. But my coaches believed in me. I had a split family like so many kids did, and they really took care of me. And I always wanted to pay them back. And so I got into my basketball coach talked me into coaching and teaching. I loved teaching. I was mainly a science teacher most of my career. Loved the administration side of things. Got into being an athletic director at Finley High School for a long time. And luckily enough, served on our a district board up in the Northwest. Then became a state board member, then became president of the state board. And I often said at that time, if I'd have known I was going to get employed here, I would have voted in the most massive raises you would have ever known. my staff reminds me it's not too late to try to do that. But
right, sure.
So I've had that background, and I think that's been very valuable for me.
Well, you mentioned rivals, and I guess I should throw in, because we can kind of make a quick topic of this. I grew up in Willard, which was in the Northern Ohio League with Upper Sandusky, and that's a league that's no longer around. There's been a lot of consolidating and shifting of leagues around Ohio. Do you expect that to continue?
I do. I think the demographics are changing so much, and people want to do whatever they can do to have, you know, equal opportunities to win. I mean, you know, competitive balance, if you want to say it that way. And I think also when you mentioned that, that's one of the great things about high school sports. We remember rivalries. We remember opponents all through our lives. And I think that's just how important high school athletics are to the overall educational and societal issues today.
So when the pandemic hit, it was right in the middle of really the height of tournament season for the winter sports.
Yes, and I remember looking back, I was talking to Mike Gatto from the Schottenstein Center, the director of the Schottenstein Center in Nationwide Arena. And we were talking in the weeks leading up, and we thought we'd get through this. We saw the pandemic or the virus itself came into the state of Washington, and we thought, wow, boy, you know, we've got some time. We'll get through these winter sports at least. And then all of a sudden, Mike and I still laugh about that, to this day, like we thought we were free and clear. And when it came with a vengeance. And on March 10th, a Tuesday, I will never forget when the governor called me and recommended, and that word recommended ended up being a very, very tough thing, but recommended that we continue with our sports, but only with parents attending. That was so incredible. And after that call, I sat there at my desk. I knew what I had to do. It was a recommendation, but I knew what I had to do. There was no doubt. And after I hung up, I just buried my head in my hands for a little while, thinking, I cannot believe that we're having to do this. We're changing 100 years of history by doing this. And that was challenging. And 2 days later, we had to cancel our winter tournaments. And, on that day, Dave, we're at the St. John Arena, a throwback year that we were going back to a place that had so much nostalgia. Two teams, one from West Branch and one from Dayton Carroll, from the Dayton area, were warming up. And I had to bring the coaches and the administrators into an area, talk to them and tell them what we were going to do. They were very professional in how they handled it. And everything has unfurled from that day.
And what a heartbreaking time for kids, not just athletes, just seniors in general at schools all over the country. But, for that to happen, during their state run, you can't even put it in words how hurtful that must have been.
Right. And I think some of the people ask me on many occasions, what's it been like for you and your staff? And I remind them that, no, we aren't the ones that had the opportunities denied, but it's been very emotional for us. It's what we do. And I have staff members here that played in the state tournament before when they were in school. As I mentioned, I'm a coach that grows. I went to basketball practice every single day of my career with an attempt to try to get our kids to the state tournament. Right. So it was a very emotional time. It was extremely emotional for our kids. And I've said so often, nothing brings communities together like high school sports. And nothing's more exciting than a state basketball tournament with communities here. And it's just so positive. And then to cancel it was the toughest thing ever.
Talking with Jerry Snodgrass, Executive Director of the Ohio High School Athletic Association. So from there, the spring sports, for a while, you were hoping that there could be some sort of a version of those in the summer, and then that had to go by the wayside as well.
Yes, and sometimes we were accused of having or giving false hope. We were never giving false hope. It's easy to look back and say that. But at the moment, I'm not sure America knew what was in front of them. And we just thought, we're not going to cancel yet. And I think I still go back to, I think that was the best move ever, is we didn't want to recant and take things, and say, now we can open up or whatever. We didn't want to reverse course. So we couldn't play and schools weren't in session, just waited out. And it became at a certain point where it was no longer practical. And I was, interestingly enough, before we had this interview, I was answering a parent because I repeatedly am asked, why did you cancel spring sports? And they're just so frustrated that we canceled spring sports. But yet I also remind them that there was not a single professional event, a single college event. What makes people think we could have a high school event? I mean, that's not why we did it.
Right.
But yes, a very tough thing, and when we eventually had to cancel.
Yeah, when you consider that Major League Baseball, which has basically an unlimited amount of money to throw at trying to make it happen, still hasn't figured it out yet. As you said, how would high schools be able to do it?
Yeah, exactly right. And I think, you know, so many people put in the perspective of, well, just because kids weren't sitting in the classroom, they were still home learning and they were going to school. That had nothing to do with it. That had zero to do with it. I don't know of a school in Ohio. Now, they could say this in retrospect easily, but I don't think they would. But I don't know of a school in Ohio that would have opened their facilities to have an event, let alone one of the uniquenesses of high school sports is they're interscholastic. A school from one town goes to another town. Well, state law requires them to take school buses to go to those. I had no authority to change that state law, and people said, well, let parents drive. Well, we can't do that. And let alone school bus drivers, you know, I mean, they weren't going to take that risk. Schools wouldn't let them. So there were all these factors that played into that that made it so challenging to even try to have an event.
Well, now we're looking at you know, the heart of it all for Ohio, high school football is next on the agenda. What's coming next?
Well, you know, and I say it, I mean, and I know we all know this, but it's not just high school football, but it's high school soccer, which is continually growing in the state of Ohio and very popular, you know, let alone girls tennis, let alone volleyball in gymnasiums, cross country. I'm not trying to leave anything out, but at the same time, I have been so forward with what we do in the fall because we don't know. Nobody knows, and I think that's the challenge. We have to be prepared for about anything, but I think one important factor is no matter what, the chance to have fall sports is dependent upon what we do now. And I think that's something we're trying to stress through our guidance. All those school sports are over for the year, but we're still trying to provide guidance to our schools to, if you want us to come back in the fall, we know that what we're doing now is so critical.
Are you connecting the return of fall sports at all with whether there's actual in-class instruction going on?
No, I'm not. Not necessarily. I do believe, and I think most people have come to grips with, the model of returning to school, or the model of school in itself, might be very, very different for some time to come. For that matter, sports as we know it may be totally different for a long time to come. So I would rather look at keeping, I'm on a call every single week with the Ohio Department of Ed, keeping track of what they're talking about on return to school plans. And that just gives me one more thing, okay, if they're going to do this, how can we make sports work? So as long as learning continues, I mean, that's the number one goal. We have to understand that, and we do. Sports are just an extension of that classroom, so not necessarily at all.
Talking with Jerry Snodgrass, Executive Director of the Ohio High School Athletic Association, Ohio State Athletic Director Gene Smith said this week that he sees the possibility of there being a limit of maybe 20,000 fans at the Shoe for home games this year, unless the social distancing is relaxed a little bit. Might high school sports also allow, you know, a limited size of crowds for games?
Let me answer that first by saying we'd be just fine if we could allow 20,000 into our games. It would be just fine. Unfortunately, that's not the way it works. But I would say that the collegiate level, and they are incredibly strapped. The collegiate model is so exposed with, you know, with this, but so is high school. And that's something that we really have to consider. We have to consider the balance between why are we playing these sports? We're playing them for the student-athlete's benefit. On the other hand, reality of it is it takes money to fund them. And I'll use football as an example. Football, the income derived, the revenue derived from high school football, in many, many cases, funds the entire athletic program or most of it for the entire year. Not all of them, but is a significant part of that. Without that revenue, there is going to have to be some incredible changes. People sometimes don't realize that when a school bus from Willard goes to Upper Sandusky, that if a football team takes three school buses and the band takes three or four school buses, somebody has to pay for those buses. And more through the years, that has been pushed on to, at least a good share of it has been pushed on to athletic departments. And where do they get that revenue? From ticket sales. So there will have to be, there would need to be a lot of creative thinking on, and we have to listen to that, of whether schools want to do this and have the funding capability, or it's just a lose-lose proposition all the way around.
Are you concerned about in the next year or in the coming years, because of this lost revenue that's going on, that schools may be looking at cutting sports programs?
I am very concerned about that. You know, we have seen that already at the collegiate level. The University of Cincinnati canceled their men's soccer program pretty quick. I'm a Bowling Green graduate, and Bowling Green, it just devastated me that they had to cancel their baseball program. And those are inevitable. Akron canceled several things. Urbana University closed altogether. I think we're going to see massive changes at that at the collegiate level. On the other hand, the ripple effect of that down to the high school levels, I still think we can provide opportunities, because I don't think there'll be as many sports cut. I do believe coaches will be cut. A football program that has 8 paid assistant coaches may only have 4. Schools are very reluctant at this point to issue any supplemental contracts for fall coaches, and I don't blame them. So I think the ripple effect of that is more going to be not the cancellation of the programs, but probably limited in the terms of the expenses that are incurred from them. I also would like to mention, though, and I mentioned that with the universities that are canceling some of their sports, I was on a call with someone from the Aspen Institute that's big in the sports, high school sports world, or in the sports world in general. And they talked about, with the cancellation of scholarships, the cancellation of certain programs, the filtering down of that to the high school, will kids start playing sports more for the real benefits of sport rather than chasing that college scholarship? And that's a very interesting thing to think about. And that person even saw with that maybe the resurgence of intramurals in high school. So we've even taken that thought internally and say, hey, listen, a lot of sports do get wiped out. How do we reinvent ourselves and look at that too?
Interesting. Colleges, major colleges that are involved in sports, the Ohio States and Alabamas and even beyond that, Indiana and basketball, whatever, they rely on the high-quality play that comes out of high schools across the country. Do they have an obligation, perhaps, that needs to be more addressed in the future if high schools begin to struggle in them keeping those programs propped up?
That is a great, great answer or question, however you want to phrase it, because we have felt all along, and not that they don't, I don't want to say this, but from the professional level down, we have always stressed, you can't do it without us, you know, and you know, now again, I think many of those franchises at the professional level, they do wonderful things. I really believe that. On the other side of the coin, too, at the collegiate level, you know, they do, too. I mean, I think that you're right. I think they're going to have to really ramp it up. I think everybody's core values are really going to be tested in this, and I think good things will rise from it.
Talking with Jerry Snodgrass, Executive Director of the Ohio High School Athletic Association, I wanted to ask about one other trend that seemed to have been developing before all this happened, and that was the concern about concussions for athletes in high school. And in the last few years, there's been a real drop in participation in boys football. And I'm wondering your take on all that.
Well, you know, I think so much of that is very cyclical. And I'm trying to think, I think it was in the, I would say the early 90s. And I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I remember in the early 90s, football participation was down unbelievably. I'm a former athletic director and coach at Finley High School, and one of the larger ones, and it was one of the larger ones at that time in Northwest Ohio. And we were down to 30-some kids in our football team. And I forget how many years later, we had 80. So I think a lot of that is cyclical. And, you know, I just think, and I think, too, you look at the advent of soccer, you look at the increases in lacrosse, one of America's growing sports. I think a lot of that participation just goes to other things.
You just announced this week the expansion of playoffs for high school football.
Yes, we did. And you know, that is really rooted in the fact, it's interesting. The football, high school football in Ohio, it is the only sport that we sponsor of the 26 that does not permit every team to enter the tournament, postseason tournament that we sponsor. So there's always been everything from let more in to let everyone in. Letting everyone in is a little bit of a challenge. So, you know, it's created a stir both ways. When we did expand with four more in every division, four more in every region being in. And what it does, it increases the opportunities, it increases the chance for more teams. And when everybody says, well, they don't have a chance to win, don't tell kids that. Don't tell coaches that. They think they have a chance to win every single game. And last year, in the current format, with eight seeds, with eight teams per region, Clyde High School out of the Northwest, as a number eight seed that barely got in, won the state championship.
Right. And it gives it much more of the basketball flavor, where you're just about, you have such a taste of teams all over the state. And as we mentioned at the beginning, these communities, high schools are the absolute anchors of these towns.
It is, and that's why I've often said that, you know, nothing brings communities together, you know, better than high school sports. And then you look at Friday night football. I mean, I just look at that. I said this last year, and when we got into August, you know, people, you'd see on different social media posts, you know, how many days till the first game, how many days till that first Friday night. And that's so special. And I love what that has created.
And then one other change that you just announced that I wanted to mention quickly was girls basketball tournament venue change.
Yeah, and that really highlights something. In all of our tournaments, from we go through a process from sectional to district to regional to state tournaments. That's our organization. Indiana does it a little bit differently. But in all those rounds, now keep in mind, in basketball, we have 800 schools that play varsity girls basketball. So regardless of how many you lump together, you have to find a place to play them. And more, it's challenging to get sites. So even when we get to our state championship level, you know, everybody, it's unique about the state of Ohio because the shape of it, Columbus is dead center. And everybody certainly has to be played there. It's dead center. It's the Ohio State University. Where else would you ever play it, even think of it?
Right.
Well, the Ohio State University isn't always available to us. And what we've realized is that we are now at a point where the commitments that the Ohio State University has, along with our lack of flexibility, we can't play our state basketball tournament in April. There are a lot of reasons for it. Easter weekend, we can't play that weekend. So it just became not available to us, and part of it is because of our lack of being able to have the flexibility. So, you know, we sought another site, going to the University of Dayton. We have worked with the manager or the director of the arena there before. He used to be the manager of Moffrey Stadium. And it's an incredible venue and an incredible basketball city. So we look forward to it. That's some very good opportunities for us.
Do you get any pushback, though, from, you know, Ashtabula? You know, that's another hour drive for them.
It is, and we get the same thing in football. And I'm sensitive to it, but I also don't have an answer to it. You know,
right.
You know, my son used to tell me, he would tell me as a football player, he said, Dad, if we were in the state tournament, we make the state tournament, we'll play on Mars. You know, I mean, and I believe that for the players.
Jerry Snodgrass, Executive Director of the Ohio High School Athletic Association. So just to wrap up here, when it comes to football, the fall sports, is there a timeline or any kind of guidelines right now for practice beginning and the possibilities of the season?
The biggest thing that we've been able to do to answer that is today, the governor announced that skill training can begin. And as long as we follow safety guidelines and distancing and things like that, that is so important, both how we do it with safety guidelines, restrictions, but but also the fact that we can do it. And Lieutenant Governor Houston said today that they recognize, and we've had a great collaboration over the last week, and he said that they recognize the importance of physical training and conditioning for fall team sports, in all sports. So that's one of the reasons why they want to do this, but do it responsibly. So I really, truly believe it was a ray of sunshine going into the fall. I really believe that. So hopefully that's a good, good start, as long as we do it responsibly, to do the skill training.
Jerry, anything else you'd like to add?
Just other than I really appreciate the sacrifices that school kids, that our seniors made. They didn't have any choice, but athletics teaches so much about perseverance and so much about adjusting and being adjusting to adverse situations. And I hope that really comes in and they can come back and smile that the sacrifices they made were for those kids behind them. They had no choice, but we recognize it and we have emotions just like they do.
Jerry Snodgrass, Executive Director, Ohio High School Athletic Association. Great to talk to you, and I hope that there's a lot of good news coming for the fall.
Me too. And I stress again, it's all dependent upon what we do now, safely.
Thanks a lot for talking to us.
You betcha. Thank you very much.
Hello, I'm Todd Markowitz, Vice President and General Manager of Radio Ohio, which owns 97.1 The Fan. We're an equal opportunity employer dedicated to providing broad outreach efforts regarding job vacancies within our company. We seek the help of local organizations in referring qualified applicants. Organizations that wish to receive our vacancy information should send their request to the attention of Human Resources, Radio Ohio, 770 Twin Rivers Drive, Columbus, 43215. If you'd like to view our current job openings, please visit our website at 971thefan.com, and thanks for listening.
This is Columbus Perspective on the Fan, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV. Here is Scott Light from his Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. Here's Scott.
Good morning, everyone. We welcome you to Face the State on this Sunday morning. I'm Scott Light. Well, has there been a rush this weekend on haircuts as businesses reopen as part of Governor DeWine's plan? Maybe a rush at restaurants and bars, too. You're going to hear from the governor and from the lieutenant governor about that. Plus, we ask about things so many of us enjoy in the summers, fairs, festivals, and pools. Plus, I continue to talk to Ohio mayors as they are dealing with the economic fallout that affects your services, from trash pickup to the police officers patrolling your streets. One mayor tells me the economic pain will last years. Then later, what does higher education look like come August? Some university presidents around the country are pushing hard to reopen campuses, others not so fast. My exclusive interview this morning with the president of Columbus State Community College. And then all of us know someone who's renting a condo or apartment or house. If they're not working, how can they possibly pay their rent? We talked to an expert on your rights during a pandemic. But let's begin with Ohio's reopening. Did you get out for maybe a little dining or that overdue haircut? No matter what you're doing, Health Director Dr. Amy Acton still warned us it's still a treacherous time.
We are in a plateaued state. We are still, the virus is still with us, as the governor always says. It's still a pretty treacherous time for us. So I think we have to remember that all of us have to double down on our efforts. And I say this to every one of you out there. It's us. It's what we do. It's how careful we are will allow us to do more and more. But, you know, all over the world, we're learning. And so we've got to be responsible as we go out. It's still not a time to have these mass gatherings. We'll be watching these spikes. There's no magic number. We look for trends. We talk to our hospitals every day to see how they're doing with capacity. And it's numbers that we will share. And I think you'll see all the leaders around the country try to figure out the best steps we can make. And we'll learn this together.
All reopenings must meet the minimum standards. We've established those minimum standards. But many businesses will add best practices, may ask you to wear a mask. Many of them will be promoting higher standards in their facilities. And remember also that just because you can open doesn't mean every business will open. on those dates, you should check with them before you head out to make sure about what the rules for their services might be. And I want to reiterate, again, we said this from the very beginning, if you're a local health department or a mayor or, and you have concerns about either the pace of the openings or the standards, you can delay those openings or increase the requirements. You have that local authority to do that if there's a concern that you have. So you can go higher standards and later, but you can't go lower standards and earlier. And that's the general philosophy that we followed throughout the process. And a reminder, final reminder, respect the employees who are working in these facilities. Remember, they have families too, and we have an obligation to keep each other safe. We are working as quickly as we can on fairs, outdoor recreation, camping and sports and the like, and gyms and fitness, because we know that these are time-sensitive issues with Ohioans trying to make plans for their summer and make plans with their children as well.
Speaking of children, Ohio daycares got word they can reopen, but with reduced numbers.
We do know that statistically kids are not impacted nearly as much as older people are. But the real concern always with child care is that you're mixing a bunch of families and these kids. Social distancing is pretty hard for a 2-year-old, 3-year-old. And they go back home. And one of them has come in. They're not showing symptoms. They don't have the temperature, so they're not excluded. But they're carrying it. And then they spread it. And then it goes back to 10 families or 20 families or however many families that child has come in contact with. So those numbers, while you may not see hot spots, you may see significant spread.
And let's talk about yet another place with lots of people who've actually been walled off from their loved ones in the name of safety, nursing homes.
One of the most important things that has been asked by CMS, and we certainly do in our state, is ask that nursing homes talk with family members whenever they have a case or an outbreak. It doesn't mean necessarily that a nursing home has done something wrong. This is a very contagious disease, obviously a very deadly disease, and getting in a nursing home, even in the best of practices, can happen. I think that's really important to say. What's most important is that we're transparent and let you know that, and then we handle that outbreak very effectively. One of the most painful parts of this pandemic for many of us is having relatives and people we love that we can't go visit. We've had to limit some of the things we normally do. And that is, you know, tragic at the same time trying to protect the people we love. So I just want to acknowledge that. And, you know, a nursing home shouldn't be ashamed to have a case. The number one thing for a nursing home, for any of our businesses who are opening up again, I say to you, ask for help if you start to see something that just doesn't feel right, whether it's in a prison, whether it's in a homeless shelter, whether it's in a business. Call your local health department. We stand ready to help talk you through it. We'll bring in the best experts we can to help you figure out the best solutions.
There is another group of leaders trying to figure out the best solutions too, Ohio mayors. So I started my conversation with the mayor of Youngstown about a minority, but a vocal minority out there of Ohioans who say they're not wearing masks out in public.
There is an embrace from what I've been able to observe from the citizens of Youngstown. Many of them are kind of more doing it so they can protect others. And I think that's kind of the message is, you know, don't do it for yourself, do it for your common citizen and your friend. It's more of a courtesy. And I think when you said it's a courtesy, it's like, well, I'm going to be polite to you, Scott. Scott, you'd be polite to me. It's working that way.
Mayor, have you started furloughing city employees yet?
We have. We did. We had about 81 individuals that we furloughed. We did a voluntary furlough. We worked with our union and non-union employees to deal with this furlough. And it was not easy for us. And we've watched it throughout the nation, other mayors that had to do it. And I watched throughout the state when other mayors had to do it. And it hit home and I had to do it. So we've had to make that tough decision. Scott, it's going to be a devastating effect that we've never seen before. Ohio is a little unique than other states. We deal with income tax as well as sales tax. So when you're talking about business not opening, you're talking about people not working, those directly impact local cities in the state of Ohio.
are we looking at in Youngstown, other cities, you know, we've already mentioned furloughs. Are you looking at safety services getting pared back, getting cut, things like police, fire, emergency services?
Yeah, if we don't see any of the federal stimulus that in a substantial amount of federal stimulus for cities like Youngstown, Dayton, Toledo, Akron, we are going to have to cut deeper. And that's going to really, you got to get to deeper into the cuts. And unfortunately, you're going to have to look at your first responders, your safety forces. So that's my last resort. Hopefully the federal government will step in to make those issues not a point for me. But if that does not happen, we will have to step in and continue with the further cuts. And when you look at loss of revenues, you're looking at loss of service and then loss of personnel. So those things go hand in hand, and we need to make sure that we get the revenues lost, put back in a great need for the cities, because it's not just our general fund, it's our enterprise fund as well. We're not cutting any water off. We're connecting water lines. So we're seeing it all over. People are not driving their cars. Gas taxes are down. Casinos are closed. So every area where we were seeing some increase or some revenue, those are all tapped in. You know, most people look at income tax or sales tax, but you got to think of all those other ancillary pieces that we take for granted that people are not using right now.
Is this pain going to last months or years financially for Ohio?
I think it's years. We're going to be talking about this next year this time, and hopefully, Scott, we'll be talking about the great recovery of the state of Ohio and the great recovery of the city of Youngstown. But I don't think this conversation about the economy is going to go away. I think if you look at the historical perspective about it, you know, economies, they bounce back. But this isn't not just the economy. This is people. These are people who are saying, yeah, how about I just do this online? How about I don't go out? Because it's not just I don't have the money. I'm not going out to spend the money right now. So that's where the hesitation may come, specifically for local economies.
You know, before we all know it, fall's going to be here. So what does that mean for students in higher education on college campuses? Next, the plan for one local college that could see a larger group of students than usual. Stay with us.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors. Back to Scott Light, courtesy of 10TV.
Welcome back, everyone. Democrats in the House in D.C. pitched another stimulus bill with a monstrous price tag, $3 trillion more dollars. Conservatives like Ohio Congressman Steve Stivers say that it's not necessarily the price tag. It's what's in the bill that he's partially against.
It may need to be something like $3 trillion, but the greater concern I've got with this $3 trillion package, it's an 1,800-page bill. I have not read it all yet. I'm trying to work my way through it. But it has a bunch of unrelated topics in it that have nothing to do with stimulating the economy and getting people back to work. And worse yet, of the $3 trillion, $1.2 trillion actually is inducements for people not to go back to work. And that's exactly the opposite of what we need to do as we're starting to open up the economy. We need to figure out how to get people back to work and help them. An example of what's in this bill that's unrelated is a $10,000 grant to everybody that has student loans to help forgive part of their student loans from the federal government. Well, in the CARES Act, we've already passed up to $10,000 tax-free from their employer that they can get to help pay down student loan. And frankly, I want to do everything we can to incent people to take those jobs back and get back to work, because the best thing we can do for people long-term is get them back in their jobs and working and get this economy moving again.
Congressman Stivers went back to D.C., and we talked about social distancing there and here in Ohio. I asked him the same thing I asked the mayor of Youngstown. What do you say to people who won't wear face coverings out in public?
I think that we all should try to wear a mask to help other people. It's not about preventing us from getting it. It's about if we had it and were asymptomatic, preventing it from spreading. Obviously, the governor has not mandated masks where he's just recommended it. And I hope and I encourage people to wear masks. But, you know, not everybody's going to. And I'll tell you personally, when somebody's not wearing a mask, I just stay further away from them. You know, I make sure I stay, 8 to 10 feet away from people who aren't wearing masks. And if somebody's wearing a mask, I'll get, 5 or 6 feet away from them. but I stay much further away from people who aren't wearing masks, and that's for my protection and the protection of my family and anybody I interact with.
Speaking of interaction with a lot of people, higher education. We just don't know what it'll look like exactly in a few months. If traditional four-year schools continue online learning only in the fall, students and parents nationally may opt for community college instead and significantly lower their expenses at the same time. In this exclusive interview with Columbus State President Dr. David Harrison, he tells me they're seeing that trend already and they're ready for it.
We're seeing that already for the summer and would expect it for the fall too. During tough times like this, people become more value conscious. We had a virtual parent conversation last night where these same kinds of questions were coming up. It really leverages strengths and partnerships that are already in place so the students can continue their learning or start their college education, as your son would, with the confidence that they're going to be safe, but also have high quality learning environment at a very affordable price.
You're hearing from those parents with that event that you just mentioned. What are they saying to you? What are their questions?
They want to know a lot of the questions that you're asking. What's fall going to be like? What's the experience of my child going to be? For a lot of recent high school grads, again, they finished their high school career in an online environment. Some of them had a very good experience, others didn't. So they want to hear how our faculty are connecting with students in authentic ways. They want to really understand, okay, they're not going to be on campus, but does that mean there isn't any co-curricular experience? The answer for Columbus State is that's not the case. We've got a really robust set of online advising and engagement tools that this crisis really has caused us to accelerate. So we think the learning experience, it's not going to be the same, but it's going to be something that, again, will be high quality and really help students get off to a good start in their collegiate career.
Do you foresee a possible influx of thousands of new students heading your way?
It's hard to say. In addition to the bachelor's degree 2+2 pathway, if you will, where students come to Columbus State, do their freshman and sophomore year, and then transfer to university to finish their bachelor's degree, we're also paying close attention to what's happening in the workforce. And as unemployment gets to near historic highs, there are a lot of people in transition who are also well-served by Columbus State. We've got good partnerships with employers throughout the region, and the ability to help people transition when they've been displaced from a job to whatever the next job is something that community colleges in Columbus State are really purpose-built to do. How much of that happens immediately and how quickly, we're not sure. It's pretty typical when there is a recession that community college enrollments grow. People do exactly what we want them to do. When they've been displaced from their job, they come back to school, get retrained for the next job. It's something that we're built to do anyway. We've really got in our DNA the connectivity with regional employers so that we're trying to partner with them, but also anticipate where the needs are going to be so that we can help communicate that to our students. Students are still going to pursue their dreams, and we don't want them to be deterred by what may be a short-term change in the economy. But at the same time, we do want them to come into this with their eyes open and really understand what the opportunities are in the short term and in the longer term. The best way for us to do that is to stay close to employers so that we've got a good understanding of what that path is going to be. Most of our students work while they're going to school. Mm-hmm. And we've been on a really good path in terms of deepening our partnerships with employers so that the job they have while they're at Columbus State is tied to the career that they want to pursue. And have even had good progress in terms of employers participating with tuition assistance and those kinds of things. You mentioned your son is in a co-op program at UC, very similar in terms of some of the programs we're putting together here. We expect that to those kinds of relationships to be even more important on the other side of this as employers rethink what their workforce needs are going
to
be.
This conversation is alluding to Columbus State being poised to handle this pandemic. What's your number one challenge in a pandemic like this?
We have a large and very diverse student body, and our students have unique needs. So the ability for us to respond to those who have recently lost their jobs, to respond to the younger students who may not have come to Columbus State, but for the fact that they can't be in their dorm as a freshman at their university of choice, so they're going to start at Columbus State, and making sure that we are continuing to build on the great progress we've already made. My biggest concern, not just for the college, but with this whole crisis, is that there's a disproportionate negative impact on the most vulnerable in our community. At Columbus State, we have been on a methodical process, or 10 years in, to closing performance gaps for low-income students and students of color, and have made meaningful progress in that regard. We had our largest and most diverse graduating class ever last year, at a time when our enrollment was nowhere near historic highs. It worries me that this crisis could undo some of those performance gains from an equity standpoint. When everyone is online, your access to broadband is a lifeline to your ability to succeed, and this has really exposed that in that regard. The only student-facing unit that we have kept open has been our partnership with the Mid-Ohio Food Bank, the Mid-Ohio Market at Columbus State. Even through that medium, we have dispersed Chromebooks to our students, mobile hotspots, those kinds of things, to maintain continuity of learning. So the ability to respond to that broad set of needs, it's the same set of needs that our community responds to, which is why we are positioned to really be an integrator in that regard. But it's something that we really are focused on. It's really in our DNA to do that anyway, to be able to do it at scale and with perhaps more extremes in terms of needs and goals of students is something that that we're paying close attention to.
You could tell Dr. Harrison's a total pro there because you probably heard my dog barking in the background at times as we did that interview from my home. So I appreciated his patience during that as well. Home renters, this one's for you. These are certainly uncertain times when it comes to income and being able to pay those monthly bills to your landlord. So we did some digging and we heard from Susan Che. She's the executive director of Ohio Legal Help. She says when it comes to evictions for not paying on time, it really depends on where you are.
It depends where you live. So for folks here in Franklin County, the Franklin County Municipal Court, which is where evictions are heard, has essentially an eviction hold until June 1st. So Franklin County won't be hearing evictions until June 1. Now, that does give tenants some time to try to work with their landlords, because while that puts the eviction on hold, the rent is unfortunately still accumulating. And so folks should reach out to their landlords to see if they can make a payment arrangement.
Che also says it's going to depend on the contract that you signed before you started living there.
Contracts are different for a lot of different situations. Usually a landlord-tenant lease has some boilerplate language. But if you're looking in your lease, you should see if there's something in there about maybe paying rent, like is there grace periods, some things like that in your contract that may help you. There's generally, in most leases, not a right to essentially pay rent late by a couple of months. So this is going to be a really difficult situation for folks. But look for grace periods in your lease.
Some grace periods in these difficult times. That is certainly something that we could use more of, especially in this pandemic. Thank you all for joining us here today. Stay safe, stay healthy, everyone.
That's again Scott Light from his Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV. This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Hi, this is Dave James, and joining me is Dennis Blair. He is involved with the Westerville Sunrise Rotary Club's annual Field of Heroes, which is going on. Thanks for talking to us. How are you?
Pretty good. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for talking to us. You're the event chair, and tell us the event that's going on this weekend.
Well, this is our 12th annual Field of Heroes, and we have 3,000 flags, 8 foot tall, that we put over 100,000 square foot field in Westerville across from the Recreation Center. It's an annual tradition to remember what Memorial Day weekend's all about. It's open 24/7, and we'll open up, or has opened up Friday.
What started this 12 years ago? What was significant about that time?
One of our members, Larry Jenkins, went and saw an example of what you could do to honor veterans at Memorial Day. And he thought he would try this with our club for 1 year with just a few flags, and then we would do it 1 year and stop. Well, that was 12 years ago, and Larry's still heavily involved. And it's turned out to be a wonderful thing and grown to be a big community event for the city of Westerville.
Now, for folks who have never seen this, can you kind of give us a visual description of it?
Well, there's lots of American flags, and they are lit up at night. So if you want to come late at night, it's beautiful to see. It's a very personal experience. So a lot of people go, and you can walk around. And in the past, we've had dedications on the flags you can read. Now, this year, we had to cancel all programming that might invite people to gather in groups. So all we have this year is the flags. There will be no concert and no ceremonies and reading of the names and things we traditionally do. But it's still a very moving experience. We are primarily a drive-through event. So if you come in, it's on Cleveland Avenue and County Line Road. We've moved the flags to line the road so you can see it's the road. We hope people will pull into the parking lot off Cleveland Avenue. And there's a queue built back in there on the parking lot where you can drive through and see the flags. We have some dedications set up to the fallen police officers and to the who we're recognizing this year as our honoree is the essential workers. We moved our theme back from what it was going to be to next year and decided this year really fits. We hope people can come out. It is a park, so it is open. And if you decide to walk, the flags are 6 feet apart, so it naturally invites social distancing. And we will have some hand sanitizer there and wash stations, but in general, we're hoping people stay in the drive-through experience.
You know, it's interesting with Westerville. You mentioned the fallen police officers, which was such a moving and tragic story out of Westerville a couple of years ago. And I don't live in Westerville, so I'm not biased in this opinion at all. Westerville just seems to be, even when you look at the traditional Memorial Day parade downtown, because the city has such a charming and traditional looking classic downtown, it almost seems, maybe it's not the right way to put it, but it gives it kind of that more patriotic feeling than a lot of cities have.
Yeah, we're a really strong community, and I love our uptown, our historic district. It's going through a bunch of nice changes, too. All new sidewalks have been put in. We're also a community that works well together. So the Field of Heroes, the Parks and Rec Department steps up heavily. The city staffers are very involved. The assistant city managers, one of our main points of contact. And so they are directly involved in helping us put this on. So it's a wonderful community because they really all get together. A lot of us knew the police officers, and so there's a direct connection. And our kids have grown up with them. My daughter was in a D.A.R.E. program with Tony. And it's sadly that we want to honor them as much as we can. So that's become a permanent part of Field of Heroes, is a tribute to the officers. We are having taps performed at sunset, and we're going to put an amplifier on that so you can hear it from clear across the whole park if you need to, hopefully. So the idea is to keep it safe as possible. A lot of it's going to be up to individuals. We've restricted all volunteers to be just Rotarians so we can control that. The city just offered, we just had a safety training class so we know, how to best respond and best be careful as we host the event.
The Westerville Sunrise Rotary Club, again, with their 12th annual Field of Heroes going on this weekend, and we're talking with Dennis Blair, who's the event chair. So it's Sunday morning. What's going on? What days are we talking about, and what are the hours, Dennis?
It runs all night. There are giant construction lights that light up, and if you're a photographer, it's absolutely beautiful at night. especially in the morning when the fog is rising up. All day Sunday and night, and we close down Monday at 2:30.
Okay, and you mentioned that there are other activities that had to be canceled this year. Normally, you've got a lot of other stuff going on with this.
Yeah, there's a lot of things. Some are still going on in a new way. So normally there's a concert by the Westerville Community Band that's very well received. They've done a live recording, and I just got the press release yesterday. So they're a virtual recording, and they're mixing it together to perform a custom-written piece. That'll be on our webpage, fieldofheroes.org. We normally have a tribute area, and that's been reduced way down to just a couple signs, and it's targeted for the drive-thru experience. There's reading of the names that had to be canceled. All flag sales are canceled, which is an issue. So what we did was one of our companies is an IT company, and they've developed a virtual dedication. So a photo can come up, and you can put in a name and your name and something you want to say, and it'll put it on the dedication, then download it to your device. That's free, and we're hoping you can either send that to them through email or post it on social media, but a way to still honor your hero. We've also always hosted a 5K race, and because of COVID, we can't do that, so we're doing a virtual 5K. And we think we passed 300 people signing up. It may be too late for that when this airs, but it's a lot of interest in being involved in that. So you can run or walk independently on your own, and we have really nice T-shirts honoring our frontline essential workers. And that turned out really well. That's surprisingly a lot of interest in that too, which is nice.
Yeah, that's great. These are some of these events that I take it, are they fundraisers to kind of keep the event going year after year?
Well, we normally take sponsorships, and we're not taking any this year except for Ohio Health really stepped up to sponsor the race. Because we don't have the expensive event, we didn't think we needed the sponsorships. A lot of companies, Franklin Equipment especially, donates the lights, and the company's donating trailer. So we have a shelter for some of the volunteers. But this is a community event. It's not really a fundraiser. You know, our point is to have a sponsor each year that we donate something to. And this year, the essential workers, the plan is to put out some signage after the event to thank them in locations they would see throughout the community.
That's excellent. Again, Dennis Blair, event chair for the Westerville Sunrise Rotary Club's annual Field of Heroes going on in Westerville. Dennis, one more time, give us the location and the particulars about what people can do to see this.
It's on Cleveland Avenue in Westerville, across from the Community Recreation Center. You can see it from the corner of County Line and Cleveland Avenue. It is a drive-by, drive-through event. So you can see it from the road if you're heading south on Cleveland Avenue. But you also can come into the parking lot and wind around the queue and get a better look and see the tributes. It's open 24/7. The park is open, so if you want to get out and walk, that's available for you. We're asking everybody to really mind social distancing. The only events, there's not really gathering events at all. Taps will be played, but we're also putting a recording of that on the web so you can hear it and see some photos. There will be virtual tributes and a virtual 5K that probably will already happen by the time this airs. That all can be seen on the website, www.fieldofheroes.org.
Okay, and again, 3,000 8-foot-tall flags also lit up at night. Dennis Blair again joining us. Anything else you'd like to add, Dennis?
No, I really want to thank the community and thank all the Rotarians because it's, you know, it was already a big debate whether to do this at all or not. And we thought being outside and the flags being 6 feet apart really gave a nice social clue to be safe and still get outside and still remember what Memorial Day is all about.
That's terrific. You know, before we started rolling tape, we were talking about how you and I and everybody else has kind of changed what used to be, you know, our everyday routines. And I think Memorial Day observances have to change as well. And this is something to look forward to.
Yeah, I think this will be nice. I do hope a lot of people come out. Not too many at once, but they all come out and get a chance to see it. Especially late at night, it's just beautiful.
Good luck with it, Dennis, and thanks for talking to us today.
Okay, thank you.
This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan, heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS AM, that's 1460 ESPN Columbus, and Sunday morning at 7 on WBNS FM, Sports Radio 97.1 The Fan. We'll be right back.
Join us again next Sunday for Columbus Perspective.